Okay, you can go ahead, Monica.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The court is now in session. The judges are Judge Ross, Judge Riley, and Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Theodora Gaetis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are here for our September 21st calendar 2021. We have five cases scheduled for oral argument this morning, and we are using the Zoom platform to hear those arguments. And I'm going to dive right in at this point and call the first case. We have both counsel present. The first case on our calendar is State of Minnesota Respondent versus Ronald James Leip Appellant. And the case number is A201643. And I apologize if I mispronounced appellant's name. Just a few words before we hear from counsel for appellant. This argument is being recorded, and an audio version of the argument will be available on the court's website shortly. We are keeping time for you on the screen today. I know that you're both familiar with our time requirements, 15 minutes for appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, and then appellant may have a 5-minute rebuttal. And that clock on the screen will count you down. I would ask counsel and any observers to remain on mute unless you are arguing so that the quality of our audio is a little better. And then finally, I will ask counsel to please identify themselves before they begin their arguments. Those are all of the remarks that I have. We're now ready to proceed with the arguments. You may go forward, counsel for appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Christina Zahar, and I represent appellant Ronald Leip. This appeal stems from a single email from the prosecuting attorney to defense counsel 2 business days prior to Mr. Leip's trial for second-degree criminal sexual conduct. I think it's important to note that this was the very first trial setting in this matter. This is not a case that had been continued numerous times for trial. Based on this email from the state disclosing an incident of presumably sexual touching between EJB, the child victim, and another child, the defense requested a brief continuance of the trial so that it may discover additional information about this touching incident. The reason it was so important to the defense is that the behavior of EJB, as disclosed by the state, the limited information we have, was extremely similar to the defense theory of the case at trial, in that EJB was acting in a sexually curious manner with her grandfather and bringing his hand to her vagina area to touch it. That was the defense theory of the case. So it was very relevant that she was acting this way, perhaps with other people.
I'm not sure that's the argument that was made to the district court when the motion was made originally. I thought the argument was made originally to the district court, not that this was just a sexually curious child and therefore these two are related, but that there was, that the revelation would potentially reveal that the child was engaging in the same alleged conduct of grabbing someone else's hand and forcing that hand to her vagina. Isn't that what was argued to the district court? Not merely this was evidence of sexual curiosity?
Both of those are correct, Your Honor. So both points were made to the district court that it was sexual curiosity and exploration that has been briefed as well, but also that she was grabbing the hand of another individual and having that individual touch her in her intimate part.
Well, that second part is all that really matters, isn't it? I mean, why does it matter that the child was sexually curious if, whether or not she's sexually curious, that certainly doesn't justify or explain why your client would put his hand on her bare vagina. It would have to be the latter and not the former as a basis for a defense, right? That she was engaged in similar conduct with other people, forcing them to touch her in ways that were inappropriate.
Your Honor, I would agree with that in part, in that the important aspect is that she's acting physically with other people. So she's not just sexually curious, within her own mind or within her own body, but she's actually acting out physically with other people. And yes, the defendant did testify at trial that she would actually grab his hand. I don't think I would use the word force to describe it. We never alleged that she physically overpowered him in some way.
Well, wait a second. That's the only justification, isn't it? That'd be the only way for him to have a defense. I mean, what other than force and sexual motivation would conceivably explain why he would put his hand on her bare vagina?
He testified that she was a very squirmy, wiggly child. She liked physical attention. She would grab his hand and put it down her shirt to scratch her back, for example, put it on her hair, scratch my hair, kind of play around with him and his body frequently. So if he's not paying attention, he's paying attention to the older grandchild who was present on all occasions. He's paying attention to his wife, who was allegedly present on one occasion, according to EJB. They're watching a movie. They are partially falling asleep in the afternoon after his long day at
work. But I'm not sure you're getting at my question. My question is, you're saying, well, it wasn't really the argument that it didn't have to be forced. Doesn't it have to have been a forced action in order for it to conceivably be a defense that supports his assertion that, yes, I touched her, but it wasn't sexual? Didn't it have to be forced?
Correct, Your Honor. It was a force in the sense of the word that his hand was moved by her actions. It wasn't force in the sense
it has to be force and non-consensual. It can't just be moving. If a child is moving his hand toward her bare vagina, he has the obligation to stop her and withdraw his hand. So it has to be. That's why it seems to me that unless it's physically forced, it can't conceivably be a defense, and that this bears upon the motion for discovery and the motion for continuance.
Your Honor, it was force, but it was not overpowering. And he did testify that he would remove his hand immediately once it would touch her vagina. The district court in this case, when it reviewed our request for a continuance of the matter, again performed the same analysis it did the first time, in that it conducted an admissibility analysis of the evidence, not a discoverability analysis, which is the exact reason it was remanded by this court after the first appeal. The district court had erred in saying the evidence is not admissible, therefore you are not able to investigate, when what it should have done, according to this court, is conduct a discoverability analysis, allowing the defense an opportunity to further discover the evidence based on this very short email.
Didn't the district court analyze it under both theories and engage had a ex parte review of the records and went through the process and then analyzed the issue under both what the court called a hindsight review and also a prospective should have review?
The court did both of those reviews, but it was the distinguish that the court made is that we either have this additional evidence that we obtained on remand versus when the court initially made the continuance review, we just had the email. So it was whether he was to analyze based solely on the email or whether he was to analyze based on the email plus the additional evidence that was obtained during the remand process.
Can I ask what it was that you wanted exactly? What did you want to do on the remand that you are not permitted to do in terms of discoverability?
Thank you, Your Honor. The remand did allow the discovery of additional evidence. So that did occur based on the Court of Appeals instructions. But the court then was to determine whether a continuance should have been granted so that discovery may have occurred and that we could have made beneficial use of any discovery that occurred to use in the defense at trial. The district court was not to decide if that evidence was admissible or not, because there are procedures in place to determine admissibility of evidence. For example, if this is Rape Shield evidence, there's a very specific proffer that needs to be made. There's a motion that occurs and standard for the court to apply to determine admissibility. What we were seeking and what this court instructed the district court to do was determine if a continuance should have been granted to allow for discovery to occur, knowing what actually happened in this touching incident.
But what kind of discovery did you want to conduct? I mean, it seems to me that you wanted to talk to the child, the other child. Was there anything else, or am I wrong about what you were hoping to do there?
We would have talked to the mother, and she is the party that testified on remand. So we would have talked to Joy Bennett, who is EJB's mother and the daughter of our client, Mr. Light.
Am I correct that, and I could be wrong about the record, but that there are no witnesses that your client sought to question who were, and you were prohibited from questioning those witnesses, whether it's the children or the mothers?
The district court did allow us to have in live court the mother, Joy Bennett. We were not able to question the child on remand. And the district court had law enforcement conduct an interview of the mother of the other child that was involved. And we received a copy of that audio recorded interview that law enforcement conducted.
Let me put it a different way.
My understanding that you were given the opportunity to call those people as witnesses and you chose not to. That's my understanding of the record.
The mother was called as a witness.
The mother of the other child was a potential witness.
Correct. The mother of EJB did testify on remand as a witness. The mother of the other child was interviewed by law enforcement, and we were given the option to ask her additional questions if we thought necessary. However, we thought law enforcement's interview was complete and thorough, and the court received that as an exhibit.
I guess here's my question. Is there any witness that you sought to interview that you didn't get to interview?
No, Your Honor. We were able to get the information that we were seeking.
My question, you argue that you would have presented a different defense if you had been afforded the opportunity for further discovery. I'm trying to understand how your defense would have been different in light of the discovery that was conducted after the first appeal.
Well, Your Honor, the defense would have been bolstered by this additional information because it would show that EJB was acting this way with other people in addition to her grandfather. The state.
That's where I'm having a hard time finding the prejudice, because you've said that you got to interview all the witnesses that you wanted to call, that there's nobody that you didn't get to call. And the information, as I see it in the record, and you correct me if I'm wrong or point to other evidence, but the record does not say that she grabbed the other girl's hand and forced her to place her hand on any of her private parts. All it shows is what you had suggested earlier, which is sexual curiosity. And that's why I was pressing on the point that you need to show more in order to substantiate the defense that you were asserting. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Your Honor, she may have done so. What we know from the interview of the mothers is that EJB is the one that had her pants down when the other mother interrupted them. And that would imply that it was the other child touching EJB's intimate parts. We would have been able to question EJB at trial about that incident.
But you didn't. You had the opportunity to question the children. You didn't seek to question the children during discovery to find out whether or not the testimony that you're suggesting would have shown up at trial would have, in fact, even ever been in the record. It seems to me you forfeited the opportunity to discover the evidence that you're saying would have supported your client, which is that the complainant was forcing other people to touch her.
Your Honor, the district court did limit access to the children on remand.
And was that challenged? Was there an objection to the limit of access to the children?
Yeah, Your Honor, that would have been on the record in the district court action on this remand, yes. The district court did not want to bring the children into the remand as he felt that the record could be complete for the Court of Appeals based on the information by the mothers describing the incident. And what we know from the mothers would have been sufficient for us to question EJB further at trial. Should a continuance have been granted, we would have obtained this additional information, and we therefore could have used it to question and perhaps impeach EJB's testimony that no one else touches her private parts. The state at trial thought this information was relevant, or the absence of the information, when in its closing argument, it argued that no one else is touching EJB's private parts. EJB isn't having anyone else touch her private parts. So why is this just happening to her?
That's not exactly what was argued. What was argued that is that no one else was made to touch her private parts, which gets to my concern about the failure to introduce evidence of force. So by anybody else. That seems to be what the argument was in context, if I understand the closing argument or if I've read it correctly, but you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure. The quote begins, EJB is not acting out like this towards anyone else. She's not grabbing other people's hands and making them touch her vagina.
Right.
But we do know another child was touching her vagina based on her pants and underwear being down.
But there's no evidence that she was made to touch it. I think I understand the argument that you're making, but it seems to me that the prosecutor's argument was there was a conjunction. It was grabbing someone else's hand and making them touch. And it seems to me you can't separate those two fairly and fairly judge the argument.
Your Honor, may I respond to your question?
You may wrap up, yeah.
Thank you. Your Honor, it would have been relevant to our defense that she was physically behaving in such a manner similar to what she was doing with the defendant under blankets in a babysitting setting, having someone else use their hand to touch her vagina. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Next, we will turn to counsel for respondent. You may proceed. And you're on mute, Mr. Raggetts.
I'm pretty sure I do that every time. Sorry. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm a special assistant Carver County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. This court doesn't need to reach the merits of either of the arguments that appellant makes on appeal because any error here was harmless. Appellant admitted at trial that he touched his 7-year-old granddaughter on her bare vagina. His defense was, and this is from your opinion in the first case, that she would grab his hand and force it down her pants. This court used the word force in its first opinion to describe what he admitted. And of course, that must be the case here. If he did it voluntarily, he's guilty. He had to claim that it was forced. And he didn't claim that while she was getting out of the bathtub and she grabbed my hand and it happened once and I gave her a strict talking to. No, he said this happened repeatedly. And he didn't just say that she grabbed his hand and forced it. He said she forced it down her pants. So this was a patently not believable defense. The jury was going to convict here no matter what else happened at trial. And that's why any error was harmless. But I will address both of the substantive issues, starting with the lack of continuance here. The failure to give a continuance here was harmless.
Right. If we believed that in the first appeal, it wouldn't have been remanded, right? I mean, if it were so true as a matter of law that the jury necessarily would have convicted regardless, because this was the defense that was asserted, it seems to me that what you're really challenging is this court's remand.
Well, Your Honor, part of the issue here is that if you look at the evidence that we now have, there is no allegation of force. So perhaps it could have been a defense that at least would have had to have been considered if there was any claim this little girl had been forcing other people to do the same thing. But we obviously don't have that here. So that has to tie into any sort of harmless error analysis. And that really gets to my continuance point, which is appellant has to show prejudice from the lack of a continuance. And Judge Wentzel did not abuse his discretion by holding that none of this other touching evidence would have come in. So the jury would have heard exactly the same case if there had been a continuance, and therefore there's no prejudice. That's why any error not granting continuance here is harmless, because the evidence is inadmissible, and it's the abuse of discretion standard here, and it's not a rape shield issue, at least initially. Judge Wentzel held the evidence was inadmissible because it would have confused the issues, and it's unfairly prejudicial. And that's correct because, remember, this other touching evidence comes after appellant's criminal sexual conduct, not before. And as Judge Wentzel explained, this other touching may actually have been a result of appellant's criminal sexual conduct, something that the child did after she had been abused by her grandfather. So Judge Wentzel did not abuse his discretion in holding this evidence inadmissible in terms of unfair prejudice, in terms of confusing the jury. And if it wouldn't have come in, then there's no prejudice from not giving a continuance because the defense wouldn't have had anything else to submit or argue at trial. And I'll digress for a moment here because appellant says, well, the state has the burden here of showing lack of harm. But on page 13 of appellant's brief, appellant agrees that the defendant has the burden in this sort of situation. On page 26 of appellant's brief, appellant emphasizes the law of the case doctrine. Well, on remand here, this court said that appellant has the burden. And this court cited the Barnes decision, which does say that. Now, appellant says in the reply brief, well, Barnes doesn't apply here because in Barnes, the continuance was requested at a different time. But that doesn't make any sense. Why should the standard of review on appeal change depending on when the continuance is requested, as long as it's requested before the defense presents its evidence, as in both cases? But regardless of who has the burden here, any error was harmless because of appellant's feeble defense, because of the lack of any evidence of forced touching, and because of Judge Wentzel's order, which was not an abuse of discretion, that this evidence is inadmissible under the rules of evidence. It's also inadmissible.
Mr. Ragatz, not to take you to, I think I understand the substance of your argument regarding the continuance. I'm wondering if I could take you to the other issue that's been raised in this case, and that is the prosecutorial misconduct issue. Appellant is arguing that the statement violated rape shield laws, and I'm wondering if you could address that argument for us.
Well, I think appellant's argument is that it violated the judge's rape shield order before the trial. But the problem with that is that that's an argument appellant could have made on the first appeal. You don't need more evidence to evaluate that argument. But appellant didn't make that argument in the first appeal. I just reread appellant's brief. Look at pages 41 to 53. That's where he makes his prosecutorial misconduct argument. There's no reference there to the rape shield order and a claim that it violated that.
Was the argument made on the remand?
It was, but it wasn't, as the state argued on remand, it wasn't properly before the district court because that's not an issue this court remanded on. This court remanded only on whether there existed admissible evidence making the prosecutor's summation inaccurate. That was the only thing remanded here, whether the prosecutor misstated the evidence here because there actually was evidence of forced touching. So what the prosecutor said was wrong. That was the only prosecutorial misconduct issue on remand. And this isn't within that, as the state argued below. Again, if you look at the brief on the first appeal, this was not raised. Pages 41 to 53, it isn't there. And you can't use plain error to try and raise a new issue when you have a limited remand here. And I think the most important point here is what the prosecutor said was true. It was literally true. It's literally true still after the evidence on remand. And indeed, appellant's brief concedes that essentially by calling it technically true. Well, appellant hasn't cited any case law that says in a situation like this, saying something that's technically true is prosecutorial misconduct. So what the prosecutor said is true. There is no evidence of forced touching. That was the emphasis here, not just no other touching, but there's no evidence she's engaging in behavior like this, forcing someone else to touch her. And there is no allegation on appeal that Judge Wentzel improperly limited the evidence on remand or anything along those lines. The argument really is just, well, we should have been able to introduce evidence that she was sexually curious. But that isn't relevant here where the allegation is forced touching. That goes back to the other issue of the continuance and the fact that this evidence is inadmissible. But I think the bottom line, to try and circle back to your prosecutorial misconduct argument, is what the prosecutor said here was true. That's not in dispute essentially anymore. It was true. It remains true. The rape shield argument was not raised in the first appeal. And appellant also argues on appeal now that, well, this other touching wasn't sexual, so because of the child's age. Well, you can't have it both ways. If that's true, then the rape shield order didn't apply to it. But it doesn't really matter here because any error was harmless in light of the evidence, in light of appellant's defense, and what the prosecutor said was true. So I mentioned the rape shield argument there briefly, and that is part of appellant's continuance argument that the Judge Wentzel improperly held that the rape shield laws would keep this evidence out. Again, you don't need to reach that because the evidence was also inadmissible just under the general principles of evidence. But the Crims case shows that this evidence was properly excluded by Judge Wentzel. Crims is the seminal case in the rape shield laws. It's been cited many, many times. No case has ever held that what Crims says about the rape shield laws is dicta, which is what appellant's arguing now. What Crims says is the rape shield laws properly exclude irrelevant evidence of other sexual conduct unless there's evidence of modus operandi. So that's not dicta. It applies to conduct before and after the alleged crime. There's no reason to limit the principle, and Crims certainly doesn't. And we don't have any evidence of modus operandi here. Again, no evidence that this little girl was forcing someone else to touch her. And no claim now that, well, the defense could have discovered that if only Judge Wentzel hadn't improperly limited them. That's not an issue before this appeal. So given the evidence before this court on appeal, the rape shield laws do properly keep the evidence out. Judge Wentzel didn't abuse his discretion. In any event, the evidence was also properly excluded as confusing the issues because, of course, if this evidence had come in, the state would have wanted to call an expert to say what Judge Wentzel explained on remand, that oftentimes children who are sexually abused will then act out with other children. And again, this other touching was after what appellant did here. So Judge Wentzel properly excluded it, which means any continuance denial was, even if erroneous, was harmless. And I think that covers the main points I wanted to make. There are a couple of things in appellant's reply brief that I would like to briefly address. And of course, I welcome any of the questions this court has. One of the things that appellant claims for the first time in the reply brief is that the state opened the door to other touching evidence, or that the victim opened the door when she testified at trial about her mom touching her and didn't say anything about anyone else touching her. But appellants forfeited that argument because appellant didn't even make that argument on remand here, much less on the first appeal. And he didn't make that argument in his first brief to this court post-remand. He has never, before his reply brief now, previously cited page 334 of the transcript and said, well, this opened the door to other touching evidence. And you can't raise an issue like that for the first time in a reply brief, obviously. Again, any error here was harmless for the reasons I've already given, but this isn't an open the door situation. This isn't a situation where the prosecutor misstated evidence. This isn't a situation where a judge kept out evidence that should have come in. And for all these reasons, the state asked that this court affirm Judge Wentzel. And unless there are additional questions, actually, looking at my notes here, there is one other thing I wanted to say. I believe the evidence here is that both of these little girls were pulling up their pants when caught by one of the moms, not just the victim here. And appellants seem to suggest, well, that shows it was the victim engaging in force. Well, even if it was just her, it wouldn't show force, obviously. But I don't think that's what the record says here, although appellant can correct me on rebuttal if I'm wrong. And with that, unless there are additional questions, I'll simply ask that you affirm Judge Wenzel. Thank you.
Thank you. I see no additional questions. Thanks for your argument. And we'll get the clock ready for rebuttal. You may proceed with your rebuttal, Ms. Zahar.
Thank you, Your Honors. The defense in this case was not feeble, like the characteristic of the state. This was a word versus word trial. It was Mr. Leip's word versus the word of EJB. There were not additional witnesses to the conduct. There was not medical or forensic evidence supporting.
Well, it's not quite a he said versus she said, word against word. They all agreed that he touched her. It was your client who raised the argument that he was forced to touch her against his will. I think that was the, if I understood Mr. Raggett's argument, that's the part that he's asserting was feeble.
Your Honor, that is correct. They both agreed that the physical touching occurred. The issue in front of the jury is whether Mr. Leip had sexual intent. Our position was that there was no sexual intent as required in the elements of second degree criminal sexual conduct when this touching occurred. And that is why this additional evidence that was discovered on remand would have been so critical to this defense, as it went directly to the primary element in question, which was the sexual intent element. I would like to add here that we know the other child was saying this was EJB's idea. The state brings up that the state could have argued at trial that...
Just to be clear, I did see that in the record, that the two children were blaming, each child was blaming the other as to who initiated it. But I didn't see anything in the record to suggest that either child was suggesting that she was forced to participate in the other child's desires.
Your Honor, neither of the children would go into that detail with their mothers. They both blamed the other and provided very limited information to their mothers about what specifically occurred under the blankets.
But am I correct that we would have to be speculating to believe that either child considered the other as having forced her to engage in this conduct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Neither used the word force. In this case, it would have been the state's burden to show that the error was harmless to Mr. Leip because his constitutional rights were implicated so strongly here. We're talking about his due process right to a fair trial and his right to present a complete defense, especially in a case like this where it is so strongly hinged on a single element of this serious crime of second-degree criminal sexual conduct. The state cannot prove that this error was harmless, and this would have been really important information for the jury to know, particularly during the cross-examination of EJB when she testified that no one else other than her mother, if it hurts or something, touches her vagina, as she said to the jury. We did argue impeachment multiple times during the history of this case and how important it would have been to impeach EJB on those specific points.
Do I understand the record correctly that this conduct with the other child occurred after the conduct that led to the conviction?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so explain again how this incident with the child would have added to the impeachment quality of your client's case.
Because when EJB testified that no one else has touched her vagina, we know that's not true. We know that's not true from this additional discovery that occurred on remand. The touching incident with the other child occurred before trial. So it happened after the allegation, but before trial. So when she testified at trial, That statement was not true, that no one else has touched her vagina area, because someone else has. We know at least one other person has, and that's this other child. We know that because EJB's pants and underwear were down, and the children described they were pretending to be married and playing sex.
And so assuming that I'm trying to figure out in my mind how that would work. So you'd cross-examine the little girl and say, no, that's not true. Someone else did touch you, and therefore it must be true, or the jury should believe it's true, that she physically forced your client's hands down her pants on multiple occasions. I'm trying to see how that works in your impeachment argument.
The jury would need to hear that she was acting out physically in a sexual manner with other people due to her sexual curiosity, or whatever she was experiencing at that time. She was acting out in a similar way with other people. The crux of the state's case was that she was not. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.